Okay.
Yeah, when I joined in 89, Jim was on the board. I'd be happy to take you through the history of that.
Yeah, he was at, when it was ImmuneTech, he was in early?
I came in as with ImmuneTech when the drug was at the FDA, the pinnipeptide for allergic rhinitis. And so I came in and they found this little company in Ramona, 45 minutes from here, that had a couple of $1 million in pharma products in the allergy space.
Yeah, what were they doing up in Ramona?
They were just a couple of guys that were trying to, just create a little business for themselves. That's where they lived, and it just happened to be that it was in the allergy space.
Yeah.
And so we bought them for $5 million.
Yeah, maybe we should circle around.
Before I get into the details.
Yeah, so we're doing the history of biotechnology. Here's some stuff about us.
Get that.
And I'm glad that have an opportunity to talk to you because we're collecting oral histories for biotech, but also I just completed a book on hybridtech, and you're one of the people that I didn't talk to. So it's good I get a chance today. And also Dennis Carlo. I hadn't talked to Dennis Carlo, but I'm seeing him later in the week.
Good.
So that's, I can wrap that stuff up.
Terrific.
Yeah. I read the biographical piece that the Union Tribune did on you a few years ago.
I can't remember what it was or what they even
said. It was a nice article.
There have been some negative ones.
No, there haven't.
Actually, when I joined ImmuneTech, there was a pretty negative.
Really?
Yeah, actually, it was, the headline was, Garner would sign up to be captain of the Titanic, or something like that.
Well, this one was highly complimentary, and it's actually very nice. But it went into some detail, some biographical detail.
Okay.
About growing up, your father was an executive at Texaco.
He was.
And he did some
traveling.
I forgot
about that interview.
I'm sorry?
I said I've forgotten about that interview.
Yeah. But can we rely on that?
Sure.
Yeah. I think it was good. So you grew up and moved around to various places, ended up in Virginia Beach.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah. When did you move there?
I lived there from age 10 to roughly 23 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the formative years.
Right, yeah. And you admit to being not the greatest student.
I was an awful student.
Yeah.
Just terrible.
Yeah.
And, some of it was, I had a father that was diagnosed with cancer when I was 4 or 5 years old.
Right.
Died when I was 17, so I kind of grew up. That was probably my form of acting out.
Mm-hmm.
And they were never home. He was in and out of the hospital most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I have... At the time, I didn't know it, but it would certainly be classified as being ADD by today's definition.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just a hands-on learner. I'm not a very good book learner.
Mm-hmm. But you did well in college.
Yeah, I just learned strategies to figure out how to study.
Yeah, good.
But I had a hard time doing that when I was young.
Mm-hmm. And you went to Virginia Wesleyan, as soon as this... In the neighborhood there?
It is. I was able to commute from home because I honestly couldn't afford. I had to work and pay my way through like most people did at that generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And double major, chemistry, biology?
Yeah.
How did you get interested in the sciences? Tell me about how that came about.
I went to junior college, frankly, just trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and I took a science course from a teacher, and I liked him, and it was actually a botany course, and we did a lot of field work, and it just stimulated my interest, and then I took a couple of survey courses in biology from him, and I just liked him.
Mm-hmm.
I had no clue as to what I was interested in.
Yeah.
I was pretty good in math. When I was growing up, my father was kind of he taught a little bit at Rice part-time and was a statistician, actually, when he started at Texaco. My brother was good in math, so that piece was pretty easy. And science is kind of a logical extension of that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the hands-on learning thing, did that going into a lab was...
Yeah, I was really good in the lab. Uh-huh. That was where I really enjoyed the lab part of it. I excelled at the lab part of it. And I ended up getting a scholarship at what's now Norfolk General Hospital, or Eastern Virginia Medical School, I guess. It was Norfolk General, then became Eastern Virginia Medical School. And I applied, when I was in my sophomore year, and got a scholarship to work in the hospital for 2 years. So I worked double shifts in the summer, and I worked 20 hours a week during school, and that allowed me to... I worked in every department in pathology. Mm-hmm. I worked by system on autopsies. I did chemistry. I did special chemistry. I drew blood. I did blood gas. I did everything mm-hmm. you could imagine.
And you were enjoying that? That was
No, I loved that part of it. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's really what got me excited about science, because that was hands-on. It was a very practical application, and I was good at it.
Yeah. So after 4 years working your way through school and studying sciences, did you have an idea of then what you might do?
Yeah, actually, I was pretty clear. I went to the Medical College of Virginia to work on a PhD in genetics. It was sort of a straight PhD program. And, you know, I had a research scholarship to go, and when I got there, I literally left in about 3 months. And I got there, I found out people were taking 7 to 8 years to graduate. And I just said, I don't have the patience to do this. You build this as a straight 4-year PhD program, and if it's not, I'm not going to do 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. Then I went into the business side, went to work selling for Upjohn Pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, how did you get that job? How was that lined up?
Just applied locally while I was still, I was at Medical College of Virginia, and I was working in a lab there. After I quit graduate school, I just went to work in a lab to decide what I wanted to do, and they interviewed me, and I enjoyed the sales part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was pretty fateful too, right? I mean, that's sort of shaped your
Absolutely.
Entire career in biotech, right?
Yeah, I think that, coupled with the fact that it worked in a hospital and got to experience diagnostics and devices, because when I worked, that certainly got me on the path to pharmaceuticals, but I went into diagnostics for quite a while and did. You worked for a company called Guilford Instruments, which...
Was that Corning?
It was actually acquired by Corning.
Before or after you?
After I was there, after I'd been there several years. And at the time, Corning was... We had bought MedPath Labs. We had KC Biologics. We had...
Is it Corning had?
Yeah, yeah. They had about $1 billion healthcare business at one time. They had...
Yeah, what years were...
That was, when did they acquire us? It would have been late 70s. Yeah, late 70s they acquired us. And I actually went after they acquired us, they wanted a token person to work in Corning, New York to sort of help sort of manage.
Be the liaison.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I loved it. They were terrific people to work with, and it exposed me to a broader industry. Mm-hmm. Guilford was a family-owned business, very entrepreneurial. I had a lot of responsibility for a young guy. I basically managed the full product line, including the development responsibilities. That was a great, and it's why I love being in startups, because you could actually do things and see the results of it in a pretty short time frame.
Yeah, and where was that company located?
It was in Oberlin, Ohio.
Okay, yeah.
And then the owner died, actually, in a plane crash, flying his own plane, and then it was sold to Corning.
I see. And you had a family by that time?
Or? We had, by the time they bought it, we had our second child. Our first child had been born, because our second was actually born in the Corning area.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you're in Corning. That's an old established company. And could you could perhaps see a future there?
Yeah, actually, I loved it, and I thought they did a good job of sort of knocking my rough edges off and refining me and exposing me to things I wouldn't have been exposed to in a small company.
Yeah, when you say rough edges, what did you learn?
Well, I had no concept of politics and how you get things done through a larger organization. And they were not a very political organization, but, you know, they had policies and procedures that were different. I mean, I had to make a decision. I could just walk into the president's office and say, I think we need to get this thing done, and we need to put it in the pipeline in terms of development projects. But Corning was, you had to put a business case together. And, you know, that's when I decided to work on my MBA. I was actually... did 1 year, and then I got promoted out to California with Guilford. It was about that time that Corning bought us. I came back to Ohio and then finished up my MBA there. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after I finished that up, I went to work in Corning, New York. Mm-hmm. And did basically planning for the five different divisions. Mm-hmm. And worked on M&As but sort of pretty strategic position for me.
Yeah, you decided to get an MBA. You're at Guilford, and you think, what was your idea that, okay, I'll use this to go on to something else, or this is a small company? And
yeah, honestly, I didn't have the foresight to, because I absolutely loved what I was doing. Mm-hmm. It was a job that I was well equipped to do. As the acquisition went through, and I started to see they're bringing people in from the outside and they didn't know the industry, I started to get a little bit, thinking more externally about opportunities. And that's when Corning said, well, why don't you come work for us in Corning, New York? Mm-hmm. And I did, and then we started a new business unit at Guilford, and they asked me if I wanted to go back and start that business unit up.
What was that? What were they doing?
Well, they were introducing a new line of research spectrophotometers. They had kind of redone the whole line, and they wanted me to take over as the worldwide business manager for them. Mm-hmm. So it was finishing the development and launching it and setting up distributors and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of running it as my own P&L.
Yeah. So did you see that project through?
I did. Well, we got it all launched, and literally I was... maybe 9 months into the job. And it's a funny story, because I was we were in our new house, and I was mowing the yard the first time I can remember, like yesterday, and my wife called me. She says, you have a phone. So I phone call, went in, talked on the phone, and it was some headhunter, and they were asking about a job in California, and I said, no, I'm not interested, I'm happy where I am. And so I hung up, and my wife later asked me, who was that? And I said, it was search guide, looking for somebody to run sales and marketing in California. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, what would you say? And I said, I wasn't interested. And she goes, why would you say that? I was like, wow, that is weird. Why would you say that to me? And then she said, well, you know, it wouldn't hurt to go meet with him. And literally 3 weeks later, I'd taken the job.
Mm-hmm. Had you been contacted before by headhunters? Did you have a sense of...
Yeah, I had, but it wasn't on my radar. Mm-hmm. And I was progressing rapidly in my career, and I was learning a lot, so...
Mm-hmm. Everything had gone smoothly, pretty smoothly for you along the way?
Yeah, very smoothly. In fact, I think one of the reasons I did so well was I literally had a new job every year. So... you know, I love the learning of being in a situation where I get to learn it.
Right.
And that's what gets me the most excited. And every year they were giving me something new to do.
Yeah, so you don't get bored, you don't get burned out.
And they knew that if I was willing to move for anything, so, you know, a lot of people had different priorities. My wife was very aligned with, you want to build a career, I'll support you.
And she was willing to go anywhere.
Yeah, she was.
So why not California? Sounds sunny. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up at Hypertech. It was
Well, who did you, you called the guy back and said?
Yeah, it was a guy named Charlie Grubenstein with, what's it, I forgot it, Scott, but they were one of the executive search firms that retained by Hybridtech. And I found out one of the consultants that we had used at Corning when I was working on the strategic plan recommended me. And I literally went in and I think I met with pretty much all the officers.
Who did you talk with?
I talked to, you know, obviously Hale. I spent the most time because Hale was being promoted.
This is 1983?
83, yeah. Hale was being promoted to CEO, and so I was basically replacing him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I met with Tim Walliger and Ted Green and David Kavikoff, because mm-hmm. David had been there just a short period of time then. And I think Cole Owen I met with as well. I think those were the key people I met with. Yeah. And I met with Brooke Byers as well.
In San Diego? Or
actually, it was at Hybridtech.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'd spent the, if I remember right, I spent the day kind of interviewing. Then I went off the next day looking, you know, a different place to live to see what the cost of living was. And then the next day, had dinner with David. And then I believe it was the next night I had, late afternoon, I met Brooke Byers. Mm-hmm.
Did you know about Brooke Byers and Kleiner Perkins? And
I knew nothing about the venture community. Mm-hmm. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And I had no clue who they were, actually.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, what was your impression? You met. What did they tell you? How did they present this
well,
opportunity?
Well, it was really more about trying to create something that was meaningful and to be on the ground floor of doing that. And it fits so well with what I had experienced at Guilford, you know, where you could come in and you could really put your energy to work and nobody was trying to slow you down. And, you know, it was all about getting things done and executing, which I love to do. And it was something new for me. It was a new thing to learn.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to take a cut in pay?
No. It was hard because I was going from Ohio at that time to California, so I couldn't afford to live out here with a cut in pay at that time. It was a big difference at that time.
And were they still giving big chunks of stock at that point? Or
they weren't big. They gave stock options. Yeah. And, you know, they actually had a really more significant package than I would have expected.
Mm-hmm.
Corning wasn't huge in pay. They just had, you know, they had great loyalty there to their employees.
Yeah. Hybridtech had a few products on the market at that time,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
Where were they at? They had some diagnostic tests, some...
Yeah, it was really early in the launch of the products, so frankly, the key products hadn't been launched yet. Mm-hmm. So they had a... They were just launching a research version of PSA, and then that was one of the two big things that I worked on.
Was that
on.
Something that was rushed through? Because I mean, I think they just figured out in '83 how to.
Well, everything was rushed through. So
right. Yeah. Yeah.
Their development cycle was pretty fast. Actually, we would launch stuff that arguably was still at least in manufacturing development anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
But so that was I had. Two things that were really fun. We, about 6 to 9 months after I was there, we started working on a visual pregnancy test, and it was really the first rapid visual.
Yep.
Yeah. So it was the ICON technology. So I got a chance to work on that, build that brand. Had the opportunity to really build the brand around PSA and educate urologists and really create that market with my team.
Mm-hmm.
And we had like Kim Blickenstaff, I don't know if you know the name, but mm-hmm. Kim, when I went to Hybridtech, was in finance, and I convinced him to come over to work for me as a product manager.
Mm-hmm.
He actually went from a director down a level to get some sales marketing experience,
mm-hmm.
and I gave him ICON. And So that, you know, the pieces sort of all tie together, and Bob Anacone, who works for him, had the PSA, and he developed the PSA, ran the marketing program for the PSA.
Mm-hmm. Well, if Hybertech was not, they hadn't turned a profit yet at that point when you arrived, right?
No.
Did Icon do it? Is that what?
I'm trying to remember if they ever turned a profit. It was confusing because we did off-balance sheet financings.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you put those on the books and ran it, we never ran a profit. You know, you could structure those things so that expense didn't hit your income statement and you made profit off of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
Didn't make profit as a real company, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe that, you know, that was important when you get a couple of years later, right? And, you know, how to sustain research.
Critical.
Yeah. The time when you arrived, there was still, how big was it? How big was the company?
You know, I actually don't remember the size of it.
83 is a couple hundred, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it wasn't that big. They were hiring a lot at that time because they were, I think they had done their first R&D limited partnership. And when I think about a year after I got there, we were doing the second one. Mm-hmm. So they had the financing to start to build up the R&D group.
Mm-hmm. You'd been at Guilford. Compare the two companies in terms of.
Well,
culture,
I think they were in some respects they were a lot alike. They were very entrepreneurial, and people didn't get in your way. I mean, you could just, you know, if you wanted to drive something, everybody that wanted to push with you. There was very little resistance to move things forward, mm-hmm. and that was very true at Guilford. I think the big difference was, there was just a really great senior team of people. We didn't have that sort of diversity of intellect and experience at Guilford. Mm-hmm. It was a bigger company in revenues, but it wasn't in terms of management depth.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was an opportunity to work with a lot of really smart people that I enjoyed working with.
Mm-hmm. And as you got to know everybody there and the company, what was your sense? Who would you credit? Not to necessarily, you know, specify who was responsible for what, but you have this great team that's been assembled. You know, what was your perception of how it got there? David Hale was in before you, but who was the driving force to make sure that the company sort of attained that kind of quality?
I think. Just my perception that it was probably more Ted than David, because a lot of the pieces were put in place by Ted.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted seemed to be pretty active in, you know, making sure we were continuing to hire high-quality people. I would say in 84, late 84, maybe a year after I'd been there, David started taking on a little bit more, I think, responsibility for building the team.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, Kabakov, you know, a lot of that was Ted's doing as well.
Yeah. And when you came here, did you talk to Ted Green? Was he here?
Yeah.
And how did he impress you?
Well, everybody impressed me with their energy and their enthusiasm about the future. I mean, it was, to a person, Kabakov was the only one I remember that wasn't quite so enthusiastic.
He wasn't. Why?
Well, partly it's his personality. He's just not a, mm-hmm. you know, that dynamic. And I think, too, he was just sort of settling into the new job, and he had a big responsibility, and I think he was feeling the weight of it at that time. And I think over time he got a little bit more comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
But that group was growing very fast, and the time pressures to get those products out were pretty significant.
Had you heard anything about biotechnology or monoclonal antibodies before coming?
A little bit about monoclonal antibodies because we bought KC Biologics at Corning, which is really more in the culture supply part of it, mm-hmm. and that fit with Corning Glass, mm-hmm. Their medical scientific glass division.
Yeah. So, what was your sense of, you know, how risky is this thing?
I probably like a lot of typical entrepreneurs, you just sort of step off the edge if it feels right.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I did. You know, I just, I liked the energy, I liked the product concepts. You know, they seemed to be moving fast and were well capitalized, but, you know, I was pretty naive. I don't know how old I was when I joined, maybe, I guess I was 32 or 3, let's see. 48, so probably 33 when I joined.
Yeah. And when you joined, any bumps along the road and the stuff that you were working on?
Yeah, I think the only adjustment for me came after about a year when, you know, David had been running that department. And he is sort of a micromanager, sort of not what you expect in a typical startup. And David kind of looked over my shoulder a bit at first, which was appropriate. But there became a point in time that it, to me, wasn't comfortable. And I actually can remember telling David that, you know, if you're going to look over my shoulder, go hire somebody that that's acceptable for. But don't do it to me, because that's not the way that I want to operate going forward. You either trust me to do a job, or you find somebody else. Mm-hmm. And he left me alone after that.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
He may have been waiting for me to do that.
Uh-huh. So, in terms of getting the products out, technical problems, or you're responsible for developing?
Well, we had all kinds of technical problems, but David was really responsible mm-hmm. for that. And it wasn't his fault. But like I said, this was all about scaling up the technology and really doing manufacturing development. And, mm-hmm. and we felt the pressure to deliver. And yeah. so often we would have problems in the field because the technology was new.
That's the point at which you would have to deal with them.
Yeah, I had to deal with the customer dissatisfaction, particularly with the sales reps.
Uh-huh. The sales reps are unhappy because the customers
were. They were pretty vocal because we went through periods where the quality wasn't as good as it should have been.
Mm-hmm. And how did that get cycled back into, you know, to the development folks?
Well, we were pretty open culture. So we had the key reps come in. We sat down with David Hale and David Kavikoff and me, and we tried to work through a plan to make that happen. And I think in defense of Kavikoff, you know, I don't think he had much choice. He had to get the products out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we paid a little bit of the price for it.
In what way?
I think in the beginning, the quality of the product.
Yeah.
Any new technology typically is going to go through that learning curve of mm-hmm. reliability.
Yeah. But these are new products, right? In the case of Icon, it's like
yep.
a revolutionary kind of thing.
Now, that one worked really well, actually.
Did it?
Yeah. Yeah, the quality there was superb. Mm-hmm. I can remember the interesting thing on Icon was pricing, because at the time we had a tube test that took 30 minutes, and it was kind of state-of-the-art, mm-hmm. and we were charging 50 cents a tube, basically. And I wanted to charge $3.50 a test. So, you know, there was a lot of hand-wringing about that. And particularly we had a distributor, CMS was our distributor, and I think there was a lot of concern internally how CMS would feel about that. And, you know, we just worked with them. I had a couple of guys in our group, and, you know, we ran them through the model, what we thought, how they could make good money on it. It was a proprietary product to them. It was a chance to brand them as a business carrying high quality, you know, leading technology to the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And we had the most successful product launch of any that we experienced at Hypertech.
So did it, the results actually exceed the model that you had? Or
yeah, it did actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no resistance on pricing at all. In fact, when Lilly came in, they raised the price again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Lilly was 86.
Yeah, it was 86.
So what was your perception about you've been there, you know, maybe 3-4 years.
Yep.
And how are you feeling about your position, where the company's going, and this, you know, you made this move out here.
Yep.
How does all that feel to you?
Well, first of all, I liked the Lilly people. They were really they were really nice people to in terms of everybody I interfaced with. They made a decision about bringing in Steve Steidel from Indianapolis, who was a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And you know, the truth is that that was disappointing, and I think we were pretty skeptical. What does a lawyer know about the diagnostics business? You've got very short life cycles, so you really got to introduce a lot of products. He's coming from an industry that has very long life cycles, and could he adjust to that? And Steve is a little controversial. I actually like Steve. I really enjoyed working with him. I felt like it was actually more of a partnership. You know, he would rely on me for decisions and perspectives, and you know, he wasn't somebody that tried to make all the decisions. And so that, you know, I was going to stay, and then they decided to replace Steidel and put somebody in with marketing experience, and that's when everybody left. Mm-hmm. Because it was clear.
Was that Don Grimm?
Grimm. And Don, I mean, I know Don very well today, but he was clueless, mm-hmm. just clueless. So would have I if I'd come from his background. Mm-hmm. It's a different industry that's not easy to learn when it's moving that fast. Mm-hmm. And so I just told myself, I'm not interested in staying. I don't need to stay. Mm-hmm. They offered me a position in Canada to be the general manager in Canada of the pharma business, which is kind of their training ground. For people they want to move through the organization. And it just sort of pissed me off. I didn't feel like at that stage of my career I needed to go prove myself mm-hmm. again.
Yeah. So the way you describe it, that Hybertech's really a diagnostic company. I mean, that's what the products, yep. any revenues coming in were from those. But there was this therapeutics program, and presumably that's what Lilly's real interest was.
I think it was, and certainly it was the sizzle in the company.
Yeah, so, and what was your feeling about that sizzle prior to the merger? I mean, what was the feeling in the company? Is this going to get big? Is the company going to need it? Is it?
Yeah, I think there were certainly, we saw that as the future, but I really didn't pay much attention to it. I was so damn busy,
right,
trying to build the diagnostics business that, to me, that was like, mm-hmm. they'll get to it someday.
And how did you feel when there was? When did you first hear about, we're talking to Lilly about?
Well, actually, the deal had been done. And David, I was in Japan meeting with Mitsubishi, and we had a collaboration. And David woke me up about 1 in the morning to let me know that they had just signed a deal with Lilly.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about that? What was your initial reaction?
Well, I was kind of excited about it because, it was a chance to make some money. And to me, it was a lot of money. I'd always worked for salary before, so to make some equity, and mm-hmm. I was still pretty young, so it was kind of exciting, I guess.
Yeah. And did you think about, well, what does this mean? And apart from the money, what's this going to mean operationally? What's this going to mean for my?
Yeah, I didn't. I just kind of trust that things sort of would take care of themselves. I don't tend to worry about that. That kind of stuff very much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the way things worked out, you decided, I don't really want to stay.
Mm-hmm.
But presumably you had some idea of, there are other things I can do. I don't have to go to camp. Yep. I don't have to stay with Lilly. I can do. Well, how did you feel about that at that time?
Well, I mean, I love doing new stuff. So I was never afraid of sort of jumping off the edge to do new things.
Yeah.
I just didn't have any reservation at all about it, actually.
And certainly at that time, there's a lot of stuff happening in biotech. Did that matter to you at all? Well, okay, I can do a biotech thing, or you would...
Honestly, I didn't think about it that thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
I was just looking for something that would be interesting.
Yeah. I don't know if Brooke Byers was still around very much or not.
Yeah, he was, actually.
Yeah. Did you ever talk to him? Say, hey, you guys...
I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't have the foresight. You know, I was still very young. Mm-hmm. I don't know, 37, 38, you know, obviously still pretty immature. And, you know, really didn't think it through very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to this point where you said, okay, I'm not happy with where this is at. And so what did you do?
Well, there was a company, a local biotech company called Centro. And Hale had mentioned it to me. And, you know, I kind of went over there and met with them. And they had a sort of a veterinary business for, you know, live viral vaccines. And they had the first product they expected to be approved. And they were trying to evolve that technology into human health.
What was it, the technology? It was a vaccine?
It was a live viral vaccine.
How were they
using
making it?
Herpes virus as the vector. Hmm. And the first product was a parvovirus. So it was, you know, used in pigs to, you know, treat.
Who had started that company? They'd been
a guy named Tom Parmeter. And, you know, essentially he asked me to come in, and some of the board members had indicated that, you know, this could be a fairly short-term thing. We think we need you to help figure out what's the strategy of this company. Can they afford to be in human health? Do we need to focus on veterinary? Mm-hmm. And so I said, great, sounds like a good project. I don't have to commit a life there. And it sounds like I'll learn something that I hadn't learned before. And so I did that for about 2 years, which, you know, got the product got approved, made the decision that this was not a company that we could finance, that it was public when I joined. And we basically sold, you know, we teed up the, got rid of all the other assets and focused around veterinary. And we had Todd, who was a veterinarian, had him run that, and then ultimately sold it. Mm-hmm. And then we basically got rid of Tom Parmeter. You know, that we sort of had, there was sort of a, about a year after I got there, we actually got rid of half the board. And mm-hmm. There was
struggle there, conflict about which way.
Huge conflict. There was Tom Parmeter, the founder, and his, if you will, cronies that he had hired, college friends and stuff, and then there were the venture capitalists that were on the board. And
who was in?
Patrick Hoff was in. Bob, I forgot who the representative was for Patrick Hoff. There was, well,
I can look it up.
Somewhere. Yeah, it's been
yeah.
so long.
Yeah.
And they weren't, you know, Patrick Hoff continued to be a player and actually invested in a deal I did in the future, but I didn't do anything with the other venture guys. And Henry Wilder, that was his name. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just went to him and I said, you know, we're not going to make any decisions unless, you know, we make fundamentally decide who's going to be on the board and who do you want to run the company. And you know, I laid out the strategy, which was to cut everything other than veterinary and try to sell veterinary. They were supportive of that, and we basically fought it out at a board meeting, and all the Tom's board members resigned, and, you know, we went about to restructure the company.
Mm-hmm. So that was 2 years, and mm-hmm. you considered that a success? You did a good job.
Yeah, it was a success for me. You know, it was a huge learning experience. I got experience in public company environment, and
how was that different?
I'd never really been the point person in raising money and interfacing with investors, so that was a learning experience for me.
Yeah, and what did you learn? I mean, how do you raise money? What's the key to that?
Well, you know, I didn't, since we weren't raising money, I was really pacifying investors at that time. Mm-hmm. So it was more about communicating with them.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I spent time with them trying to help them understand the decisions that were in front of us.
Did you have a title? I mean, this is great.
Yeah.
CEO training.
Yeah,
right?
No, but I was CEO.
You were CEO.
I came in as president, then became CEO after Tom
stepped
down. I see.
Okay, yeah. Right.
And the understanding when I came in as president is that I would take over
I see.
As
yeah,
CEO.
Okay, yeah.
And Tom would stay chairman.
Yeah.
was the concept. But that got moved forward a little bit. And the venture guys said, look, I don't care what the title is, you're going to be the guy. They knew Tom, he was not an operating guy.
What was his background? Was he an academic? Or?
Yeah, he was an academic.
UCSD? Or?
I can't remember, actually. But it wasn't his forte, clearly.
So he restructured the company and then...
It ultimately got sold to Solvay for the animal health business. And I was going to take a year off and just kind of relax and enjoy myself. My kids were at an age where...
How old were they?
Gosh, they were, at that time, that was, they were 9 and 7. So it was, you know, it was a little time to spend with the kids, so.
Right.
And, you know, the next thing I know, I got a call from David Hale, who was on the board at Dura, saying, you know, they're looking at acquiring this company, and, you know, wasn't sure. So Gordon Ramsier, who was the CEO of ImmuneTech, came over and we spent some time, and you know, I decided that actually that sounds pretty interesting. And you know, we had a letter of intent with this company. He wanted me to come in and finish the diligence, do the acquisition, run that business unit as president. And
you would run Dura?
I would run Dura. Yeah. So we would acquire this entity in ImmuneTech. It would become the commercial arm for the company. We expected the pentapeptide drug to be approved, and that I could build out this organization and run it. And you know, that's about all we thought through at the time.
Yeah, and it is interesting to me. A couple guys in Ramona, and they were just, you know, who were they? Where did?
It was a guy named Tom Evangelisti and Craig Wheeler. And they had come out of, I forgot which pharma company they worked for, but they just decided they would do what, you know, what's called today is these DESI products that didn't have a formal approval process when they were approved many years ago. But you could make copies. I mean, it was pretty easy. You just formulated them and introduced them. You didn't have really a regulatory pathway. Now, there was no protection. You could try to brand them, but it was effectively a generic play.
Right.
And the barriers back then were very low to introducing new products. And, you know, they had, I don't know, 6 or 8 products that totaled $2 million in revenue. And they had 8 or 10 sales reps. So it was, you know, it was just a little...
Where were they manufacturing?
They were using contract manufacturers,
yeah.
Which typically you do in that segment.
Uh-huh.
And they were... you know, sort of typical cough cold products, some allergy. But.
And they were ready to get out of it?
Gordon Ramsier had identified them. I don't know, he ran into them at one of the allergy and immunology meetings, and they were local, so Gordon took a look at them and thought it made sense. You at least have a little revenue to kick it off and a few people that kind of know what they're doing in this space. So they had put together a letter of intent to acquire them, and you know, again, it was $5 million was the acquisition price, and we, you know, I came in, finished the acquisition, and you know, they were kind of high maintenance guys. They, you know, they thought they could still run the world when after you give them the money, and you know, just. Really didn't understand the concept how to operate maybe in a larger company. And then I had been there maybe 3 months, and we had the FDA meeting, and the drug didn't get approved.
The ImmuneTech drug didn't get it. So that was a big...
Yeah, so you know, basically there was a fork in the road. We did not have the capital to go do another clinical study. You know, investors couldn't raise the capital to do it, and
who was
so we had from Advent, we had Jerry Benjamin, we had Jim Blair from Domain, we had from NEA, we had Okay. Frank Bonzel.
Yeah, well, these are all top flight.
Yeah.
And nobody was willing to.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, because, you know, there, it was an uncertain outcome. Allergy studies are very difficult to do. I mean, typically, if you look in a lot of the early allergy drugs, they took multiple studies to get a high enough end to get efficacy. And it was, they just didn't plan to do that much. And so I can't remember. I think it was Jim had asked me on the side, and he said, well, what do you think we ought to do? And I said, well, I think you ought to shut it down, and let's see if we can build a business around Dura and try to license the products in. And no discussion about how it was going to be managed. Just asked for my opinion of how to structure it.
Yeah, and what was your idea about, what was your conception of how big you could make this thing? It's $2 million a year in revenues. Where did you think you could get it to go?
I honestly didn't know at that time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in some respects, I was new to the specialty pharma business. And had spent most of my years in diagnostics other than my early years. But I just knew that there was no other alternative other than to try to hunker down and see if we could build products and, you know, introduce some more branded generics that were low development cost and then try to license, better drugs to build the platform. Mm-hmm. And there really wasn't much proof in that concept at that point in time. So it was, the specialty pharma kind of hadn't been created as a segment quite yet.
Were you aware of other people doing that sort of thing? Or
they were doing more development work. Yeah, it was really the genesis of the acquisition, build through acquisition strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And of small products. People certainly were trying to buy larger products, but most people did some development back then. So we didn't want to do any development in the early days. Mm-hmm. We wanted to either do line extensions or acquire existing products with existing revenues that were frankly discarded by mm-hmm. Big Pharma.
And you thought you could do that cheaply and you had enough cash to do it?
Well, we thought we could do it and raise the money because, it seemed like a good model, maybe a more predictable model than, sort of drilling for oil, if you will.
Right. So you couldn't raise money for a clinical trial, but you could raise money for this.
Yeah, it was a little hard, but...
yeah?
Yeah, we basically got... think about how naive I was, but... I think if I remember the number right, Jim would know that basically they bridge financed us and then we got to an IPO. There was an opening in the market and we went public and raised our first real capital to go acquire products and build the company.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a window in the market where anything could go public.
Uh-huh. So that was a stroke of luck.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What were the years? This is 89.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. So we went public, I believe, in February 92.
Uh-huh.
If I remember.
And
right.
So you'd started with ImmuneTech.
I think it was November 89.
Yeah. They had been around a while, right? They were one of the early biotech companies here.
Yeah, they had been around quite a long time.
You knew them, and at Hybertech, you knew of them, and
I honestly didn't know them.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I kind of had my head down. I really didn't know what was going on the periphery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, Jim Blair is the one that I fully credit with building this company because, first of all, we had this difficult decision to make about, okay, if this is, we can't afford the R&D, so who's going to run it? And, I can remember having a meeting with Jerry Yakutan, who was running the R&D, Gordon Ramseer, myself, and Jim Blair. And at least to my recollection, Jim asked me, and there's probably somebody else there, what do you think we ought to do? He had already talked to me, but in front of everybody, and I told him, and he said, well, who do you think ought to run it? And I said, honestly, I'm the best person to run it because I have a strong commercial background.
And something that you wanted to do.
Yeah.
you saw that, no, this is an opportunity to do something.
Yeah, no, I think it was exactly what I knew how to build commercial organizations, so it made good sense to me. It made good sense to the investors, and so we asked Gordon to step off, and then, you know, we fortunately were able to sell the R&D to Tanabe, so we got rid of a lot of burn rate, and Jerry went with the R&D group and ran that for Tanabe, sort of the U.S. R&D group.
How crucial was that sale to make?
It was important because we had a high burn rate.
Yeah.
And not a lot of cash left.
Uh-huh. And you had 2 years as a CEO with Syntro. That was also real important for you to be in that position, too.
I think it turned out to be that, you know, it showed a little bit more seasoning maybe in being able to sit in a bigger picture and deal with, you know, kind of difficult circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So 1992, you went public, and this is where you got the first large chunk of cash enabling you to operate.
Yep.
And so what did you do with the
money? Well, we actually went on a path of you know, launching more branded generics to build the revenue stream, building the sales organization so we could grow revenues just by having more reach than we had before, because we were pretty geographically constrained with 10 reps. Don't go very far. So we invested the cash a lot in reps. And, you know, it was sort of, it was trying to get the flywheel started, if you will, because you couldn't license products credibly unless you had a sales organization.
Uh-huh.
And so it was sort of a chicken and egg. And once we got the flywheel started and had a big enough organization, we were credible, and then we could license and ultimately license better and better products as we built the company.
Yeah. And how do you evaluate products? You've got some established sales. How reliable is that projecting?
Well, it's a bit of an art form. I wouldn't call it reliable, but you know, typically you got these neglected products with big pharma that were unpromoted, and so eventually.
So you were taking stuff out of pharma companies.
Oh, absolutely.
That they,
yeah.
They
yeah,
were
like
just
we,
not paying attention.
We took C-Clor CD from Lilly. We acquired that from them. And Keftab, which were good products but unpromoted, and they gave us some, you know, pretty good revenue. And, you know, we began to turn those products around.
Yeah, how does that work when you say unpromoted? They were selling them, they just were not putting any money
behind
it?
Too small for them.
Yeah.
And that's what that's really the strategy that we, I think, Dura created and developed, is that we started looking for orphans within the large pharma that were basically neglected and unpromoted.
Yeah.
And it could be they had a strategic shift, wasn't important to them, or they're ones that are getting close to the end of the patent life and they're too small, or ones that they launch and never gets to the sales level that makes sense for them.
Yeah, so you're not necessarily then looking to improve sales for any particular, not necessarily?
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely we were.
Yeah, for all?
Yep.
And that's something, you only took things where you say, okay, we can make this bigger?
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
That was certainly part of the formula. We had to convince ourselves that we could grow revenue of those products.
Mm-hmm. How did you do with that?
We did well. I mean, we obviously continued to build the company and raise additional capital, and we're, you know, able to continue to leverage that presence, continue to build the sales organization. I think at peak we were well over 500 reps, so we were a pretty good size organization and credible in terms of licensing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I guess during this period is when people start talking about this model, right, this specialty model. Then do you remember publications, the Wall Street Journal look at it?
Actually, if I'm not mistaken, Brian Dovey wrote an article on it.
Early on?
Yeah, and he did a case study that he published, I believe, for UVA or somebody.
Ondura?
Yeah.
Okay.
So they, you know, they kind of, you know, it became a strategy that other people began to follow.
Mm-hmm. And who were some of those? Do you recall
some that did a lot of? Oh gosh, forgetting them all. There were a lot of them.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Most got most got bought.
Yeah.
But what happened was
Well, that's funny. Who bought them? Pharma rebuys them.
Yeah, I know. It's a kind of... Well, what you saw is that you saw a lot of people like... what's a Canadian pharma company? Quickly, I forget. But you see a lot of them that had typical development stuff that started to look for products that had existing revenues. Mm-hmm. So it was the way that they could forward integrate, I guess, mm-hmm. And look for products. So it wasn't just other specialty companies, but it was, you know, other people right. that were development model companies looking for products to acquire.
Mm-hmm. I see. And it, is it still a viable model? Still
yeah, BioVail was an example of one that started doing that. That's a Canadian company. Mm-hmm. It didn't become as viable because the multiples started going up. As competition entered the space, you know, if you could buy them for 2x revenue, now you were buying them for 3x revenue. Mm-hmm. So you had to be able to drive sales a lot more
to
get the returns, yeah. and it got harder. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's a model that doesn't work very well today because of that.
Mm-hmm. But during the time you were at Dura, this is the 90s, up until... Well, tell me the chronology of
Well,
Dura.
We sold the company in 2000 mm-hmm. to Elan. We sold it for... It was $1.9 billion was the sale price. Mm-hmm. So in the 11 years that we paid $5 million, we ultimately sold it for $1.9 billion and grew revenues north of $300 million and were profitable.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we certainly had our ups and downs along the way.
Yeah. What were some of the ups and downs?
Well, I think one of them was, the biggest one was that we actually did a couple of off-balance sheet financings to develop our own technology.
So you did get into development.
We did.
Yeah.
And it was a disaster, actually.
What did you try to work on?
Well, we worked on a dry powdered inhaler for asthma.
Was that the Spiros thing?
Yep, exactly.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was really a great concept at the time. It was just an example of the FDA kept refining the regulatory requirements. And when we first developed the model, we thought in terms of cost and time to develop it, it made sense. But by the time we worked through with the FDA what was required and they kept advancing it, it got to be developing a new drug.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Has anybody else picked that up and made it work, the technology?
No. That's one of the things they got rid of. You know, they were... Certainly, there have been other dry powder inhalers that have been introduced to the market that have done well.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's a standard technology that's out there today.
Uh-huh.
We were just early, and frankly, we were naive about the development cost.
Yeah, and the people who did make it... Who are the companies that did... make that work? They had greater resources than big pharma companies that did it?
Yeah, well, they had the guys in San Francisco, Inhale Therapeutics, who eventually did a deal with Lilly. We did one on inhaled insulin. They did one with inhaled insulin with Pfizer. Lilly dropped it for a variety of reasons. The biggest is the economics didn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
You lost so much drug in the formulation process and creating a powder that the cost of goods got mm-hmm. prohibitive.
Yeah. And were there other projects that you wish you hadn't gotten into?
No, that was really the big one. I think the smartest one we did was acquiring the products from BMS. So we decided there were two hospital products, Exactam and Maxipine, that were hospital anti-infectives, and we acquired those products, and they did very well for us.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, after we acquired them, when we brought one of the marketing guys over to run that for us after the acquisition to build that group, and that's Ted Schroeder, who's CEO of a company we started together, which is in the hospital
mm-hmm.
products, a company called Cadence.
Mm-hmm. Grow to $2 billion. Were you the biggest pharmaceutical company in San Diego at that point?
Yeah, I think actually, I think that was the largest sale at that time. Aggeron, I don't remember what Aggeron was.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it was pretty big, too.
That was around the same time, right?
And then IDAC, obviously, for ultimately a much bigger number.
Yeah.
But it was certainly one of the bigger,
right.
bigger ones, and at the time, it may have been the largest.
Yeah. So up until 2000, this is occupying most of your time, right? You're at Dura.
Yeah, we did do a company where we took some of our older products that we couldn't promote anymore, spun it out in a company called DJ Pharma, mm-hmm. and I was a chairman of the company, and we ultimately sold that for $220 million to BioVail. Mm-hmm. And then when we sold it to Lon, I convinced them to allow us to license two products from them, and we created a company called XL Pharmaceuticals, and we ended up selling that to Valeant for close to $300 million.
Mm-hmm. And around 2000, then, I mean, a lot has happened in San Diego over this since you first came.
Yep.
Hybertech in 1983, you're here to watch all of this develop. You know, when now it's time, you're thinking, oh, what do I do now? It's a completely transformed environment, right?
Yeah, so, totally different.
Yeah, well, what are your reflections on that? Did you think about that?
Yeah, no, I did. I mean, that was when we had sold the company. You know, I was really trying to decide how do I want to spend my time? Do I want to get back into an operating role in a company, or do I want to help build companies? And I decided I would be better at helping build companies instead of running them. Mm-hmm. And
presumably you still could have done a great job running them, but
yeah, I just felt like I could leverage myself more. You know, I had mm-hmm. I understood how to raise money, understood the business strategy. We had a great group, a deep management team at Dura, many of whom are running companies today, and so I had all the kind of essential resources to create startups, mm-hmm. and. So to me, it was kind of an obvious mm-hmm. Way to move forward.
And you have all sorts of contacts. Hybertech people are around
yep.
everywhere, and the venture people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jim Blair became a great. I mean, he financed most of my companies. At least it was.
And that's why the proximity here.
Well, it just
it's just accidental.
Actually, we're just no. Actually, it's more accidental than anything.
Yeah. Well, everything is.
Yeah, I wanted everything on this road, basically, because it's close to me.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the guys live in this area, in the Carmel Valley area, so it was an easy sell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, we got the lawyers on the street, and, you know, IP lawyers and
right.
general counsel, and all the resources are right here.
Right. And so now 30 years on, all the resources are here. When did that really sort of coalesce?
I don't know if there was any point in time. I think it just kept evolving as the industry built.
Is there anything lacking? What does San Diego need?
Well, I think the only thing that I'd would love to see more of it, if it were the home of more venture capitalists. I think, you know, you still have an advantage in San Francisco because, frankly, all things being equal, they prefer to find deals that are local versus flying down here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These days, you know, discovery stage startups are not getting funded, so, you know, stuff coming out of UCSD or Scripps or SOC, I imagine it's harder to get those things going.
Yeah.
What's the feeling around here in terms of, you got to get going?
I've got a little bit. I've got a 3:20 appointment with my doctor just to...
Okay, we can wrap up.
It only
here,
takes me 20, 25 minutes to get there. So
okay, well, we can...
I'm good probably till a few minutes before 3.
Okay. What's your... you know, what's the feeling here in terms of sustaining this? Or, you know, specialty, you can't... That's something you can't turn to that model to do the old venture model with the, you know, the discovery stage startups.
Yeah, you know, we sort of evolved. The first few companies we did, like DJ Pharma and XL and Skinmatica.
Yeah, I need to get the chronology on these. Can you tell me? Okay, I'll have to look it up.
No, it was certainly DJ Pharma first.
Yeah.
And then it was XL. Mm-hmm. And then we did Skinmatica. And then we did Sumaxin. And then we did Varus. And then we did Meritage. Then we did Evoke. And, you know, we're working on a couple things now.
Yeah, no, this is a bunch of things. So what's your role? I mean, how are...
The early, you know, the first two that we did, like, as part of Dura and then the spin out of Dura with XL, you know, that my role was 100% of finding the management team, raising the capital, mm-hmm. and mentoring the CEO, mm-hmm. which is a job I'll enjoy doing. Then, David and I, Hale and I started an interface, and we always interface a lot. We've known each other a long time. And so he introduced me to Skinmatica and said, what do you think? So we put money in and got that started. Then we sort of started working on deals together. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, kind of, I take the lead in one, he might take the lead in the other. We just, you know, we sort of co-founded. You know, he took more of the lead in Skinmatica and Sumax, and I took the lead in several others. But the model evolved from being a kind of fully integrated companies to being virtual companies. For me, the model, David's a little different now. You know, I'm interested in doing less than 10 employees, getting it to an inflection point in development, and selling it mm-hmm. to try to minimize the capital and, you know, frankly, minimize the number of employees that you have to deal with. Mm-hmm. A lot of reasons for that.
Yeah. And you say David's approach is a little different?
I think he's come around to that, but I think he really got hung up on the build a company longer than I did. Mm-hmm. You know, like Sumaxin, I probably wouldn't have gone that route. I probably would have sold it mm-hmm. earlier instead of trying to build, you know, your one product company. It's, you know, how do you, it's hard to buy, develop the second product because you can't tend to buy them anymore. So the strategy is a little unclear to me when you start thinking about building mm-hmm. a fully integrated company unless you got a $500 million or $1 billion product.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Then you can afford to build off of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't find those everywhere. So it's really changed.
Yeah, dramatically.
Uh-huh.
And there's been a fundamental change just because of there's not a lot of venture money out there right now. They're all faced with the same problem of returns haven't been good because there's kind of no exits, and they're trying to make their money last longer, so they've got more of the portfolio companies that can't get to the next inflection point. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of difficulty in the process over the next couple of years, I think.
Difficulty for who and what?
For all the startup companies in this space mm-hmm. until this kind of rings out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that it was a good example of the industry got bloated because, you know, there was so much money that we started funding the fifth or the sixth or seventh product in a category.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that model doesn't work. The returns just aren't generated other than maybe the first or second person in the space.
Mm-hmm.
So the return started going down and money left it. And now you got a lot of people that frankly don't belong in business. You know, they weren't people like Blair that really, in my mind, is, you know, kind of a leader in the industry. They were more followers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a fundamental change. I think the number of firms will drop and the amount of capital they raise will be reduced until they can start showing returns again.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, when people, civic leaders in San Diego look at, did they see this thing growing, shrinking, you know, are they, well, you probably talk to them, yeah? What's their feeling?
Well, this industry is kind of, you know, it's done a little bit of that. I think we're just in a bit of a down cycle now, but
you're optimistic.
Yeah, I think long term, you know, mm-hmm. we'll get there. But it's just, you know, sometimes it's lean times.
Yeah, but virtual companies is the way to go, and you don't see
Well, there's that. A lot of debate about that, whether the model works any longer about doing these kinds of companies that are kind of virtually organized and run.
Whether that works any longer?
Yeah, which is, I don't know why they're debating it, because the only other option that I know of is you buy public companies, mm-hmm. or you do early stage development and try to get a really high value asset to an inflection point with maybe, you know, 1-2A study, or but it's high risk, high reward, and I think they've got to do the barbell approach, where if they do some of that, they're going to have to find some that are sort of the other end of the risk spectrum. The risk on this spectrum is exit. I think execution isn't as big a risk as will the exit be there?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
You know, it's easy for sentiment to change when the economy's not good, but I don't think the fundamentals change.
Right.
You know, you've still got an industry that needs products, and just happens right now most of them need more cash than they need products short term.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me any good stories about Hybertech? You got any funny stories?
It was wild, I'll tell you. I don't know if I have any funny stories, but it was a real culture shock to me. You know, the TGIFs, you know, the parties we had on Fridays were, you know, culturally I'd never experienced that before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of the openness that the management team had. And you know, I think the other thing that was interesting to me was the level of debate within the organization. You know, it was a very healthy, open culture that with a lot of aggressive debating.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the stories are probably some of them, most of them probably best left unsaid.
Okay.
But I can remember, I'll never forget when we were developing a CEA test, an Abaddon in the market in CEA. And so Ted thought, well, if we introduce ours at $1 a share, we'll kill Abbott because that's all their profits. And he was convinced of that strategy. So he's
going to take down Abbott?
Yeah. So he came down to me and he said, what do you think? And I said, I think there's a chance in hell. I said, you know, they bundle their products. You're not going to make an, because the customers can't figure, there are these contracts, there are multiple drugs, they can't figure out what they pay. Mm-hmm. But he was so convinced, so I convinced him, I said, okay, well, let me go to one or two territories, and we'll go to a few accounts each, and see how they would respond.
You took Ted out?
No, I just had a couple of sales reps I called,
okay,
that were our better reps.
I see.
And I said, I wanted you to test out the strategy, and wouldn't work. But Ted would have these ideas occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd come in the office one day and those, Ted called, you have a meeting with this firm that wants to do your advertising. So I don't know what you're talking about. Well, Ted would just take it on himself to call these guys and have them set up a meeting with me, and he would come. And then leave.
Was that a little annoying sometimes?
Yeah, it was actually comical.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't annoy me. You know, he was passionate, he had our best interest at heart, but it just showed you how Ted was clueless about how to operate a company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ted is an extraordinary visionary and very, very passionate about what he does, but he really doesn't know about how to operate a company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at some point, maybe you know what was going on. David Hale was going to take over as president and run the company. And I think at that point, Ted became chairman.
Correct.
And Brooke Byers was making an exit. Did Brooke step aside to permit that, or do you remember anything about that?
Yeah, I don't remember that. I think Brooke stayed on the board.
Yeah.
But I think Ted took over as chairman because David transitioned pretty quickly after I got there, I would guess a year, to be CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not even that long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was when he recruited me, it was apparent that he was like became chief commercial officer, or chief operating officer, mm-hmm. when I joined. And it was pretty clear he was going to take over, and there was, frankly, a pretty seamless...
Mm-hmm. I just wondered if Brooke Byers, if he was taking a step back from everything at that point, or maybe he just said, okay, well, here's something for Ted to do. He can.
I don't know, but Brooke was on at the board meetings and still very active in the board meetings and stuff.
Right. Anything else I should know?
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, well, I'll call you.
Please do.
All right. Thanks for taking the time.
You're welcome.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Any directions in place?
No, I know. I did my PhD at UCSD, so I know the place.
You can find your way around.